Good afternoon and welcome to Lunchtime with Sal Lennie with Maurice Newman. Today, if you were listening last Friday, you'll know that the theme of these Friday shows is about writing, learning to write, reasons for writing, and great books that we've read. Later on, I'll be talking to Noel from the Malahide Writers Group, and we'll be hearing some of those works read out by one of our staff here, Dylan Hayes. Right, to move on to the writing. As last week, I'll start off with some tips on writing, and if you're thinking of writing a book, perhaps it'll give you some inspiration of a way to go forward. This week, I'm going to talk about narrative tension, the arc that keeps you reading a book. If you pick up a mystery murder or a murder mystery, there's a body on page one, and wanting to find out who the murderer is will keep you turning the pages, hopefully, if the book's well written. This is your narrative arc. On the way, you'll need some MacGuffins. We'll talk about those later. Just to be clear, though, it doesn't matter. If you have an idea for a book, you're going to have to make it interesting to read. So it doesn't really matter how lively and characterful your neighbourhood is, for instance. If you live around here, you might hear great funny things in the supermarket every day, and there are great characters around who are always joking and use very, very colourful language. But if you just concentrate on doing that and saying, like, what a marvellous place it is that you live in, what you're going to end up essentially with is a list book. List books sell. We all know, you know, the top 10 thing is about being Irish, the top 10 worst mistakes I ever made. These books actually sell around Christmas, but if you're a writer who wants to tell a story, you're going to have something more than just a list of events joined together by nothing more than the fact that these are people that you meet. So we said it's good to establish the tension early. Murder novels, very easy. Kill somebody on page one and don't find out who it is until the last page. But you're going to need a MacGuffin. And a MacGuffin is essentially a plot point that keeps the protagonist of your novel interested. It keeps the people in the book or the story or the film moving forward. I'll give you examples which may be easier to understand. Lord of the Rings is a book essentially about people taking a long walk. The MacGuffin is the ring, the one ring that binds them all. If there's no ring that has to be destroyed, that everybody's fighting around and trying to get hold of and getting control of, then the story is just a walk in the park and has no interest whatsoever. MacGuffin is a term, Alfred Hitchcock coined the term, and he uses in all his films a MacGuffin. His most famous one is the Maltese Falcon, in which the Maltese Falcon is the MacGuffin. Other famous ones, Pulp Fiction, the movie Pulp Fiction. If you remember the briefcase that John Travolta and the other hitman find, you never find out what's in the briefcase, they just open it and it's light. The cheesiest MacGuffin I've ever seen or heard of was the one in Avatar, in which the unobtainium was the mineral that they were mining for on this distant planet. I don't know why they couldn't come up with a better name than unobtainium, but there you go. Now, I said before that you can't really just go through the minutiae of your day and write this and make it interesting. It's difficult and it's hard to keep the attention of the reader. But people do it, but you have to be a fantastic writer to do this. The best example I can think of a book without an apparent MacGuffin, but with a very definite one, is A Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich. This is by Alexander Solzhenitsyn. And it's about a day in the life of a man who's in a prison camp in the Gulag. And in detail, it just goes through everything from waking up to surviving on eating the breakfast of water with a fish eye in it, the work he has to do, the stripping of bodies to get clothes to keep warm. The tension in that book is not like what's going to happen in the future. It's will he get through that day? If he gets through that day, then he'll get through the week. If he gets through the week, He gets through the month, if he gets through the month, he gets through the year, and then the decades. And then there is some hope. If he goes to bed and goes to sleep and does not die, there is a hope that he can survive to the end of a seemingly endless sentence. And that's what keeps you reading. Last week, we took a reading from To Kill a Mockingbird. And within eight pages, we were able to sort of see the whole history of the town in which the people in the book live. We know about their family history. We know all the characters quite well. We're kind of with the characters and are interested in them. And was set up with Boo Radley. And Boo Radley is the MacGuffin. The children are only interested in Boo Radley. They want to know who he is, what he does. They want to see him in the flesh. But the book is actually about racism and justice in the Deep South. So the MacGuffin isn't the plot. It's what keeps the characters in the book going and keeps your interest in it. A master of establishing the MacGuffin is Stephen King. We've all read King at some time or another. He's so prolific that it's difficult to imagine a time when he wasn't writing. So a sample of his writing here, it's being read for us by Dylan Hayes. The first four pages of The Stand. Now, this was written in 1978, and I think you'll agree that by the end of four pages, you'll be gripped and ready to go out and buy the book anew. Here we go, The Stand.
Sally, a mother. Wake up now, Sally. A louder mother. Leave me alone. He shook her harder. Wake up. You got to wake up. Charlie. Charlie's voice. Calling her. For how long? Sally swam up out of sleep. First she glanced at the clock on the night table and saw it was 2:15 in the morning. Charlie shouldn't even be here. He should be on shift. Then she got her first good look at him, and something leapt up inside her. Some deadly intuition. Her husband was deathly pale. His eyes started and bulged from their sockets. The car keys were in one hand. He was still using the other to shake her. Although her eyes were open, it was as if he hadn't been able to register the fact that she was awake. Charlie, what is it? What's wrong? He didn't seem to know what to say. His Adam's apple bobbed futilely, but there was no sound in the small service bungalow but the ticking of the clock. Is it a fire? She asked stupidly. It was the only thing she could think of which might have put them in such a state. She knew his parents had perished in a house fire. In a way, he said. In a way, it's worse. You got to get dressed, honey. Get baby Levon. We got to get out of here. Why? She asked, getting out of bed. Dark fear had seized her. Nothing seemed right. This was like a dream. Where? You mean the backyard? But she knew it wasn't in the backyard. She had never seen Charlie look afraid like this. She drew a deep breath and could smell no smoke or burning. Sally, honey, don't ask questions. We have to get away. Far away. You just go get baby Levon and get her dressed. But should I... Is there time to pack? This seemed to stop him, to derail him somehow. She thought she was as afraid as she could be, but apparently she wasn't. She recognised that what she had taken for fright on his part was closer to raw panic. He ran a distracted hand through his hair and replied, I don't know. I'll have to test the wind. And he left her with this bizarre statement which meant nothing to her, left her standing cold and afraid and disorientated in her bare feet and baby doll night tie. It was as if she had gone mad. What did testing the wind have to do with whether or not she had time to pack? And where was far away? Reno? Vegas? Salt Lake City? And... She put her hand against her throat as a new idea struck her. AWOL. Leaving in the middle of the night, Charlie was planning to go AWOL. She went into the small room which served as baby Levon's nursery and stood for a moment, looking at the sleeping infant in her pink blanket suit. She held to the faint hope that this might be no more than an extraordinary vivid dream. It would pass. She would wake up at 7 in the morning, just like usual, feed baby Levon on herself while she watched the first hour of the Today Show, and be cooking Charlie's eggs when he came off shift at 8 a.m. His nightly tour in the reservation's North Tower over for another night. And in 2 weeks, he would be back on days and not so cranky, and if he was sleeping with her at night, she wouldn't have crazy dreams like this one. And hurry it up, he hissed at her, breaking her faint hope. We got just time to throw a few things together. But for Christ's sakes, woman, if you love her, he pointed at the crib, you get her dressed. He coughed nervously into his hand and began to yank things out of their brewery drawers and pile them helter-skelter into a couple of old suitcases. She woke up baby Levon, suiting the little one as best she could. The three-year-old was cranky and bewildered at being awakened in the middle of the night, and she began to cry as Sally got her into her underpants, a blouse, and a romper. The sound of the child's crying made her more afraid than ever. She associated it with the other times Levon, usually the most angelic of babies, had cried in the night. Diaper rash, teething, croup, colic. Fear slowly changed to anger as she saw Charlie almost run past the door with a doubtful handful of her own underwear. Brass straps trailed out behind him like the streamers from New York's Eve newsmakers. He flung them into one of the suitcases and slammed it shut. The hem of her best slip hung out, and she just bet it was torn. "What is it?" she cried, and the distraught tone of her voice caused baby Levon to burst into fresh tears just as she was winding down to Sniffles. "Have you gone crazy? They'll send soldiers after us. Charlie, soldiers. Not tonight they won't," he said, and there was something so sure in his voice that it was horrible. "Point is, sugar babe, if we don't get our asses in gear, we ain't never gonna make it off in the base. I don't even know in the hell I got out of that tower. Malfunctioned somewhere, I guess. Why not? Everything else, sure, God malfunctioned." And he uttered a high, loon-like laugh that frightened her more than anything else had done. "The baby dressed? Good. Put some of her clothes in that other suitcase. Use the blue tote bag in the closet for the rest. Then we're going to get the hell out. I think we're all right. Wind's blowing east to west. Thank God for that." He coughed into his hand again. "Daddy," baby Levon demanded, holding her arms up. "Want daddy? Sure. Horsey ride, daddy. Horsey ride. Sure." "Not now," Charlie said, and disappeared into the kitchen. A moment later, Sally heard the rattle of crockery. He was getting her pin money out of the blue soup dish on top of the shelf. Some $30 or $40 she had put away. A dollar, sometimes 50 cents at a time. Her house money. It was real then. Whatever it was really real. Baby Levon, denied her horsey ride by her daddy, who was rarely if ever denied her anything, began to weep again. Sally struggled to get her into her light jacket and then threw most of her clothes into the tote, cramming them in helter-skelter. The idea of putting anything else into the other suitcase was ridiculous. It would burst. She had to kneel on it to snap the catches. She found herself thanking God baby Levon was trained and there was no need to bother with diapers. Charlie came back into the bedroom and now he was running. He was still stuffing the crumpled ones and fives from the soup dish into the front pocket of his suntans. Sally scooped baby Levon up. She was fully awake now and could walk perfectly well, but Sally wanted her in her arms. She bent and snagged the tote bag. "Where are we going, Daddy?" baby Levon asked. "I was a-seepin'." "Baby can be a-seepin' in the car," Charlie said, grabbing the two suitcases. The hem of Sally's slip flapped. His eyes still had the white, starry look. An idea, a growing certainty, began to draw in Sally's mind. "Was there an accident?" she whispered. "Oh, Jesus, Mary and Joseph, there wasn't there? An accident, out there. I was playing solitaire," he said. "I looked up and saw the clock had gone from green to red. I turned on the monitor. Sally, they're all," he paused. Looked at baby Levon's eyes, wide and although still rimmed with tears, curious. "They're all D-E-A-D, down there," he said. "All but one or two, and they're probably gone now." "What's D-E-D, Daddy?" baby Levon asked. "Never mind, honey," Sally said. Her voice seemed to come to her from down a very long canyon.
Right, well, there you go. The Stand, nearly 40 years old, and well worth reading again. Excellent, excellent bit of writing. So Stephen King's earlier books, definitely very, very good. Some people feel he went off the rails a little bit in recent years, but he has come back with one called Mr. Mercedes, a fantastic thriller. It's about two books back. He turns them out so quickly, but if you see Mr. Mercedes lying around, pick it up. You're bound to enjoy it. There's another book that is brand new that I picked up this week. It's called Life or Death, and it's by Michael Robotham, published by Little Brown. And this, as I was saying, it goes back to what I was saying earlier about a book needing a hook to get you in. This has a fantastic hook. There's a chap who's been put in prison for armed robbery. He's been shot and put away. He's done 10 years. He stole $7 million in the armed robbery, or one of his partners stole $7 million, and it's in cash, and it's stashed, maybe. He's served the 10 years. He's about to get out. He's about to be released the next day, but he escapes the night before he's due to be released. And in Texas, this means he'll get 25 years extra for escaping early. Why is he running? And you follow this chap's journey as he meets people on the way, and he goes back to the people who did the robbery with him. And I won't give anything further away except to recommend it as a really cracking read and a great example of how to create a narrative tension that will keep you turning the pages. And if you look at it properly when you're reading it, you'll find that it might give you some inspiration if you're thinking of writing something. You know, it doesn't have to be a thriller. But any form of book that needs narrative tension. We're going to do one more piece of music, then we'll go to the break. And when we come back, I'll be talking to, or hopefully I'll be talking to Noel from the Malahide Writers Group. Hello and welcome back. We're just going to hear a poem from Peter Clark. And then we'll be speaking to Noel Amihenna from the Malahide Library Writers Group. Okay.
Authority by Peter Clark. He stomps through the house, slim, tall for his age, squeals with absolute delight with every unfolding of some newfound thing. He captivates them with heart-melting smiles, laughs, giggles, or simple hand flicks and child-speak commands.
Hello, and now we're going to talk to Noel Amihenna from Malahide Library Writers Group.
Hello, good afternoon.
Hello, Amihenna, how are you doing? I'm sorry, hello, Noel. I got mixed up with the names there. That was a piece from Peter there. Quite a nice little poem, actually. I quite enjoyed that. How many people do you have in the writers group in Malahide?
Well, it varies, Morris. Sometimes we could have three people showing up, and sometimes we might have a dozen or so. So it just depends on who's free on the night.
Okay. And what's the situation? I've been to a number of writers' groups myself, and some of them operate as a learning process where you go along and you read your piece out, and the people that are there kind of criticise it and go, oh, you need to edit this or do that or make suggestions. And other ones I've been to, you just read out your piece and people applaud enthusiastically, regardless of the quality that it may or may not have. Where would you stand on that line, do you think?
I suppose we wouldn't say we're a writing class by any means, because we're all amateurs. There's no teachers specifically there. So we're just there to be supportive and to help each other out. And the format of the group would normally be where we'd probably chat for maybe a bit longer than we should, just about our general news, and then we would each get a chance, if we wanted, to read out a piece, either prose or some poetry, for a couple of minutes, and then if anybody had any feedback that they wanted to share with the person who's just read out, they might give some encouragement, maybe mention what they particularly liked about it, maybe give any suggestions or other comments that they might feel would be helpful to the writer. But there's never any onus on any member of the group to contribute something. It's totally voluntary if they want to or not. So we try to be open and welcoming and supportive, I suppose, to any person that would like to come along to join us.
Right, yeah, and do, at the end of the evening, do you sort of suggest a theme for the next meeting? Or do you just let it grow on organically as it goes along?
We have done in the past where somebody might give a suggestion of, say, three random words chosen, and somebody could go away and write a story on that. Or maybe sometimes we would mention a competition that we've heard about, maybe on the radio or online wherever, and maybe some people might like to give that a go. There was one a couple of weeks ago called Chicken Soup. So it was on an online forum where there was the start of a story called Chicken Soup, with about a couple of hundred words. Then you had to fill in another 300 words to finish off that story. And a few of us entered that competition, and we had fun reading them out the next week at our own group, you know.
Interesting enough. And would that inspire you to do a little something like that for yourself? To go like, oh, look, let's try that. And this week's words are, I don't know, let's think of something random. New shoes.
New shoes, earrings and window. There you go. it can often be a nice little spark. And even some weeks, if we have maybe 10, 15 minutes towards the end of the group, we might decide to do some free writing, either inspired by a phrase or one week we did some haikus, you know, these short, I think they're Japanese type poems, which are 17 syllables long.
Just. That's right, yeah, 5, 7 and 5, isn't it, the makeup?
Something quite precise, yes. Yeah. I'm not a poet myself, but we all had a go and it was fun. One of the ladies had already done some in a different class she was involved with. And they were inspired by the natural elements. So we all had a little go with that, and that was fun. Some weeks we do have a bit of free writing, and some weeks it's just chocker full of people reading out pieces they'd prepared earlier and getting feedback on that.
Okay. I have come across haiku before. And if anybody's listening and has ever fancied having a crack at poetry, but felt that it might be a bit much to start producing sonnets or prose poems, haiku is a great way to begin. The poem has to be 17 syllables long, 5 syllables on the first line, 7 on the second, and 5 on the third. And the great thing about haiku, the most inspiring thing, is that no matter what you write, it can be the most awful bloody nonsense, it still sounds very profound. And I think that really sounds... If you just read it out in the right tone of voice, it's going to sound like you're really a deep thinker. So I suggest you have a crack at that and see. I heard one this morning about sprouts.
Brussels sprouts, yes.
Yes, indeed, yes. just give it a whirl. You'll enjoy it, I know. That's for the readers. You don't have to, Noelle. You can... You've already done it. You'll be all right.
Thank you. Well, it was amazing to just hear the different types of haikus that a group of 10 people could come up with in 5 minutes. It was quite diverse. Very interesting.
You can, if you write those all down on a piece of paper and hand them to somebody, you'll sound like the most intellectual group in the country.
Absolutely.
I'm going to just very quickly play another one of Peter's poems. It's called A Winter Walk in Malahide Castle. Do you mind, could you just hang on for us a minute there, Noelle, and we'll come back to you?
Of course.
That's great. Thanks very much.
A Winter Walk in Malahide Castle by Peter Clark. Early morning mist has lifted. The air is crisp and cold. Sunshine splinters through bare-leaved trees. The ice path slips underfoot. A man shuffles an arc with 3 old dogs. Runners pound past, felt in vibration. A scene I didn't think I'd see again spreads out beyond the rich green pitch. The sea, Donabate's sloped beach, a broken ring of sand beyond broad meadow. It builds a good-to-be-alive feeling.
Hiya, Anne. Noelle. Oh, sorry, I was looking at Anne's name there. I'm going to be talking about Anne in a couple of minutes. One of your groups just had a book published and there's a launch coming up, is that right?
That's true, yeah. Adele Cush is just about to publish her book called The Lady Bird Flies, and she'll be having a book signing on the 5th of December. So that's a Saturday, the 5th of December, 10 o'clock in the morning until midday, and that will be at Manor Books in Malahide. So we're very excited to have one of our own members actually going out there and publishing her book.
That's fantastic. And that's self-publishing, is it? This is the new growth industry.
Yes, that's true. Yeah, she's jumped into that, and we wish her all the very best.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I've spent some time over the past 6 months trying to get a book published, and it's a very difficult process. It's a very tight market nowadays, and I think there was a time maybe 30, 40 years ago when it was a slightly more easygoing, if you like. You might write to a publisher and they would see a book and say, well, you know, it's got promise. It's maybe if we edit it, we could go. I don't think that happens anymore. You have to produce something that's absolutely stunningly perfect and marvellous. And even then, there's no promise. I mean, the prime example would be J.K. Rowling and the Harry Potter books. A woman who had written all this series of books and was turned down by 50 publishers, one after the other, who all said it had no commercial value. So I think
Stephen King sits in that bracket too, of having quite a few rejections before he finally made success.
Yeah, well, I'd say there's hope for us all, but I'd be frightened of putting myself in that bracket, to be honest. I would like to one day get published. But in the meantime, I do see that you hear more and more that what happens is people are doing their own publishing, and then the big publishing house, if they see value in it. And if you are beginning to make money from your own project, they'll step in and up the ante. So that seems to be a very... it's all about the commercial side of it, isn't it, really? It's no longer about just writing to get stuff off your chest.
Yeah, although in our writers' group, I suppose it's totally up to any individual to come along and either read for pleasure, read out to us, or try to go through the publication route. It's very much what each individual is hoping to get out of it, you know?
Yeah, indeed. I'm actually just talking about the reading for the pleasure. I actually read a piece by Anne, My Winter Musings, and this is an example of a piece that's very much written for pleasure, I think. I don't see that she's sitting down and decided, I'm going to write something that's going to make me some money. I'm going to do something here that gives me pleasure and hopefully gives the people who hear it or read it some pleasure. I'm going to finish with that, but before I go, can you just tell me what nights you meet there, and perhaps if anybody wants to pop along, perhaps we could encourage them to do so.
Yeah, sure. We meet every month, usually the very first Wednesday of the month, in Malahide Library upstairs, and there is no charge. The room is free to use, and anybody is welcome to come along. And if they want to just to confirm that any particular Wednesday of the first of the month is going ahead, they can just get in touch with Malahide Library.
Okay, what time do you meet on the Wednesday?
We meet at 6:45 and we finish just before 8, because the library closes at 8.
Of course, yeah. Okay, well, thanks very much for talking to us, Noel. I'm going to move straight into Anne's winter. Anne's, is it Anne Christie? Anne Archer.
Anne and her special guide dog Ash come along to most of our meetings, and they're the very friendliest and very prolific regular attendees. We love to have both Anne and Ash come along. Ash is a lovely golden retriever who works with our guide dog, so it's a pleasure to have them.
Well, I think Ash gets a mention in the poem here, in the prose piece, and again. Yeah, well, again, thanks very much for talking to us today, Noel. And
you're
hopefully, maybe we'll speak to Idel in the coming weeks and see how her book is selling.
Very good.
Okay, all the best now. Thanks very much. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Morris. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
My Winter Musings by Anne Archer. Suddenly darkness surrounds us. Days close their eyes. This heralds the onset of winter excitement. My usual morning collar emerges, and with her warm, cool nose nudges me, and with that small woof, the day has started for me. As I awake from a warm and dreamy sleep, I hear those light, tripping paws announcing Ash's approach with another gentle morning woof. This is the signal for us to venture out of doors. Dragging on my dressing gown, struggling to find my slippers, I fling open the door. I gasp and fight to catch my breath as the frost-laden air envelops us. Finally, winter has arrived with a vengeance. We no longer hear the whispering of those leaves drifting down to earth, leaving a carpet of colour. The silence of the morning continues. However, there was one brave robin with a chirpy song. His red breast feathers create an imaginary flicker of light. Serving Ash her eagerly awaited breakfast, and she with enthusiasm wipes her bowl clean. No need for a dishwasher here. I too trundle into the kitchen, where there is a kettle boiling and a simmering bowl of hot porridge. I feel vigour entering into my veins. I now plan our morning adventure together with Ash. That winding path at the back of our home beckons us, and I don my warm long woollen scarf and hat and that jacket just waiting to shelter me from that sharp east wind. Now I know that winter is taking over. We set out as Ash, her tail wagging. We thread our way to savour the tapestry of winter jewels, just waiting for us to explore. Through this mantle of cold, the garden smells are very sharp. The damp, musty smell arises through the carpet of fallen leaves. Now surrounding us are those small, subtle signs portraying winter yet displaying very vivid traits. Those tall, elegant trees are without their wonderful foliage, and as the leaves filter finally down to earth, they are accompanied by the whispering sound of faint rustling. Here is their eventual resting place. However, their task is quite simple, to revitalize and furnish the earth, to make preparations for the promised growth of spring. This is looking ahead, almost through a pretty kaleidoscope, where the green and lush of spring awaits us. My kitchen also takes on the guise and traits of winter. Suddenly, the fragrance of Puget spices, fresh garden herbs, the hot cloves and burnt cinnamon wraps itself around me. The aroma of cooking dominates my small kitchen and introduces us to the array of goodies. This is mirrored in the recipe for old-fashioned country brown bread baking in the range and wholesome hearty soup laden with fresh vegetables simmering on the cooker. Adding to this tableau are mugs of rich hot chocolate, giving us that final element of sweetness we crave. We are now ready and nourished to face the demanding rigours of winter. On a fun level, which I will share with you, my guide dog Ash also senses the approach of winter is inevitable. So she rushes into the M&S store to purchase her woolly thermals and drought-free vest. Having donned them, she is now a fat, fluffy and contented dog. Now let us endeavour to express the hidden treasures that winter keeps closely guarded. Winter takes a rather slow approach to revealing all her talents. The warmth of colour releases slowly onto her palette, displaying warmth of feeling. It is stark, this pallor of winter which stretches before us, revealed only by the vibrant and beautifully strong brush strokes of colour. Although the days run shorter, within this darkness we can escape from the trundling world of hustle and bustle. I do feel strongly in a positive mood as those flakes of snow drift down to the earth, covering our world. The gentle snow, in the guise of the goddess Chiani, brings with it a profound world of silence. This image can be paralleled to that pretty dancing girl moving in elegant sweeps. We see those long fair tresses dropping down to form a magic tapestry of beauty and silence. This is only interrupted by that final brave thrush song with its promise of renewal.
That was Winter Musings by Anne Archer. Lovely little piece there. Something for everybody, I think. And now the time has come, after a couple of weeks of talking about other people's writing and giving tips to other people on how they should write, and perhaps complaining a little bit about some people's writing, I'm going to take the risk of reading you a piece of my own. I hope you enjoy it. It's the first two or three pages of my book, The Bears. There's a plot, but most of it's in the title. So here we go. The Bears, by me. Jacko. Bears, you can't trust a bear. They're bastards. But they've had some great PR over the past 100 years. Teddy bears, Paddington, Disney's version of Baloo. Everybody thinks bears are lovely. Cuddly, cute, endangered. Endangered? Christ on a bike. See how endangered you think bears are next time you find yourself within grabbing distance of a 10-foot-tall, 1,400-pound Kodiak bear with a grievance. Or an appetite. The Kodiak, Latin name Ursus Arctos Middendorfi, is bigger than the grizzly, Ursus Arctos Horribilis, but smaller than the polar, Ursus Maritimus. Now, while size matters a little bit, you can take it as read that if you get into an argument with any of the above, you will lose. And quite a lot of your previously valuable, to you, body parts will become snack food. Bears eat people and pretty much anything else that moves. They don't think it's cruel or unusual. It's not personal. It's dinner. All of the above constitute no more than 20% of my total number of reasons for thinking the County Wicklow Bear Sanctuary and Breeding Programme is a stupid idea. Not all the reasons are bear-based. People can be pretty single-mindedly self-centred as well. Not the least of these would be Ursula O'Shaughnessy. Ms. O'Shaughnessy, Sula to her many, many friends, is your worst nightmare. Fabulously wealthy, Irish celebrity, magazine-style famous, reasonably well-educated, or, if you prefer, finished, and happy to jump on any bandwagon as long as it's currently popular and will contribute to her public profile. This year, bears are in. As a result, I'm here as head gamekeeper. For the past 6 months, I've been cheerfully driving around the countryside, making the kind of fences that keep people a safe distance from hungry bears. You'll have seen the sort of thing in zoos. Concrete and reinforced glass are common features. I can't see the point of trying to breed a 14-foot bear myself, but if they do, this fence will keep it safely tucked away. They don't let me into the main camp compound, where the serious scientists work. I hear the program's well underway with two live specimens romping around. I occasionally talk to kitchen and maintenance staff who've seen the new arrivals, but they aren't bear experts. They can tell me there are two bears in there that are getting a lot of attention, but as far as they can tell, the new bears look exactly the same as the old bears, but a bit bigger. I'll get my first good look today when the compound goes live. I don't want to seem to be blowing my own trumpet or anything, but when it comes to bears in Ireland, I'm your man. There's no point harping on about it. Suffice to say that I've worked with bears for some 15 years, mostly in northern Canada, but also in Scandinavia and for a short while in the Arctic. The work's largely been in the field of conservation. Surprisingly, this mostly means finding bad bears and shooting them. You can't do much else with a bad bear. The good ones are difficult enough. Anyway, Sula put her not inconsiderable political weight behind the idea of a County Wicklow bear sanctuary and breeding programme. Why, I'm not sure. To get on telly, I suppose. She made the case, weak in my opinion, that because bears used to be part of the Irish wildlife scene, they should be again. There is some truth in what she says. The Irish brown bear, Ursus arctos, did inhabit Ireland up until the last glacial maximum, between 15,000 and 24,000 years ago. Then it died out, which was pretty lucky for all the people who came after. As I said earlier, bears are bastards, and the fewer you have in your immediate vicinity, the safer you are. Sula, however, and some of her less glamorous chums disagree. They want Irish bears back, and they want those bears to be the best in the world. Between them, they've come to the conclusion that the best bears in the world will be the biggest bears in the world. So, a bear breeding programme. That's bad enough. But here's some extra interesting news about the Irish brown bear, as was. It was fucking massive. A full-grown polar bear can weigh in at 1,600 pounds and be up to 3.6 metres tall. The good old dead Irish brown would have been some 15% bigger. That's heavier than 10 average men and taller than two basketball players. And it's a carnivore. We're not talking giant cow here. We're talking giant, vicious wolf. On all fours, it's over 2 metres high at the shoulder. Still, Sula and her lovely pals think these would make a nice addition to the Wicklow countryside. Fenced in, of course. We wouldn't want them roaming around all over the place scaring the horses. That'd be silly. Eating the horses, more like. But the bottom line is, I've got a nice little 9-to-5 job that I drive to from a flat in town. And I can live like a normal human being instead of a 19th century frontier scout. Why argue? Right, well, that was an extract from The Bears. And hopefully you're all very excited and thinking that's marvellous, marvellous stuff. And you can't wait to hear more. Or maybe you're not. There's nothing really to do about that. Coming up next is Doug Rogers with Here's to the Bands, a little look at jazz and swing music, which is a very, very popular show and one which I'm sure you're going to enjoy. All the best. And next Friday, if you want to get in touch for next Friday, do contact reception at Near FM. And if you want to send something in for us to read or you'd like to argue with me about anything, feel free to do so. All the best. Bye-bye.